We're checking in on the latest treatment protocols as physicians manage patient care for COVID-19. Currently, no medication is recommended to treat the disease. No cure is available. But since March, doctors have learned a good deal about how it attacks the body. So what do you want to know about treatment progression? What things have you heard about treatments or drugs that you want clarified? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Jerry Wainaina is an infectious disease specialist. She's an associate professor of medicine and surgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and she's medical director for antimicrobial stewardship for Frederick Health, and she leads Frederick's COVID treatment protocol. Dr. Wainaina, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here.
Well, explain for us, when you bring in a patient who is coming into the hospital to be treated for COVID, what are some of the first treatments or some of the first tests that are done on the patient?
When it comes to testing, the first test that we would do specific to COVID-19 would be the COVID-19 test to establish whether or not they are infected. We have the good fortune to have an excellent lab that were early adopters, and we had access to good testing from the end of February. And so we were able to get that going fairly well. Now, there are a few patients who would come in with clear symptoms and the test would be negative. What would happen is we would treat them as if they have COVID-19 and test them again to confirm, and usually we were able to confirm.
So when that test, when the test comes back positive, or it's pretty clear or almost very clear that that patient has COVID-19, what do you do from there?
So then the next thing we would do would be to get another set of tests to establish how they're doing in terms of their kidney function, their liver function, just so that we know where they are, how to treat them, and how to monitor them. The bedrock or the foundation of our treatment is really supportive. So supporting their physiological or their bodily functions, because we really don't have a cure. So making sure they're getting the oxygen that they need via whatever means works best for them, whether it's via cannulas that go into the nose or a mask or high flow, or do they need to be on a ventilator, providing extra intravenous fluids, and so on. So best supportive care is the foundation of our treatment.
Dr. Wainaina, what can be done to protect the lungs? Because COVID-19 really does a number on the lungs.
It does. And as one of the things we learned early is that it causes what's called acute respiratory distress syndrome, which often would lead to patients requiring mechanical ventilation and other interventions. This is not a new syndrome. This syndrome has been associated with other conditions in the past. And one of the things that's done for that is to nurse people prone, so have patients on their bellies to try and open up more of their lungs so that they can oxygenate better. So what we started doing early on in the disease is not waiting until they get to the ICU and nursing them prone, but rather doing it when they're in the hospital room on the floor.
How have you seen the way you treat COVID patients? How has it been evolving in these recent months? It's only been a few months where you've seen this dramatic rise in cases.
That's been quite a journey. So early on in March, like everybody else, we were going through all the literature that was coming through. And, you know, it was kind of like drinking from the fire hose. There was a lot of information coming through. We had to dig through the details because not all of it was peer-reviewed and try and sort out what's true, what's not. There was a lot we didn't know. So like everybody else, we started with what seemed to be working, which was hydroxychloroquine. By the time we got to the middle of April, our team, which is my team that's been working through preparing the guidelines and updating them over time, along with the other specialists in the hospital taking care of patients in our emergency department, in our ICUs, our pulmonary critical care specialists, and our hospitalists who are inpatient specialists, realized that it really didn't seem to be working. So they kind of stopped prescribing it. And shortly after that, we had more literature that was not really convincing. So we took that out of our guideline. In the meantime, other options were coming up, such as convalescent plasma, remdesivir. And so we started moving in that direction. Where we are right now, based on the literature, has been using plasma in our more severely ill patients, as well as offering remdesivir, depending on our supplies.
And we're going to be talking about both of those areas. Dr. Jerry Wainaina is an infectious disease specialist leading Frederick Health's COVID treatment. Have you or a loved one had COVID-19? Were you hospitalized? What treatments did you get? What looks promising right now? What do you want clarity on? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Wainaina, as we look at medications, another one that's been in the news is a steroid called dexamethasone. What is this drug? How does it work?
So dexamethasone is a steroid, and essentially what it does is it dampens our immune response and dampens an inflammatory response wherever it's occurring. We have learned over time that it seems like there might be two phases of COVID-19. The early phase is really more due to the virus, and the later phase seems to be more due to the body's response to the virus, which is an inflammatory response that might be a little more exuberant than necessary, and then which then causes us harm. And that is what causes our body systems to shut down, you know, causing respiratory failure, among other things.
How significant, when you see new potential drugs that are used for other types of ailments, you know, how do you approach that? You're obviously looking at the peer-reviewed research, but it's also new and perhaps experimental.
This is true. Everything we have right now is experimental, in the sense that it's never been used for anything before, such as remdesivir, or it's been used for other situations or other conditions, and we are now repurposing it based on either some experience with other coronaviruses, like the first SARS or MERS, or basic principles. We think that the disease causes inflammation via production of certain what are called cytokines or inflammatory products that the body produces, and we know that there are certain medications that can suppress those inflammatory mediators, and so we attempt to bring those two together.
We're exploring treatments for managing COVID-19, what doctors are trying, with infectious disease specialist Dr. Jerry Wainaina. She's medical director for antimicrobial stewardship for Frederick Health. An antiviral drug, remdesivir, as mentioned, has been approved to treat severe COVID-19 cases. What do you want to know about this medication and others being tried on patients? Have you heard about convalescent plasma? What do you want to know about antibodies? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute with Dr. Wainaina right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're asking about the latest patient treatments for COVID-19 and what to expect in a hospital stay. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. About half of all states have logged an increase in their 14-day average of new reported cases after many lifted restrictions in recent weeks. What do you want to know about hospital treatments, the outcomes, the status of PPE, personal protective equipment? What treatments have you heard about that could be promising? Join in 800-642-1234. Dr. Jerry Wainaina stays with us. She's an infectious disease specialist at Froedtert Hospital. Dr. Wainaina, let's look at convalescent plasma. We heard about it early on, and this type of treatment has been around for at least a century. How is it going?
I would have to speak anecdotally here, meaning just based on what it looks like from the patients that we have given convalescent plasma. It definitely does seem to help, although we are learning that we need to time it right. It appears that if we give it too late in the disease or in patients who are too severely ill, it may not make a difference, whereas it doesn't help the patient, doesn't seem to help the patient who has very mild disease. It's those people in between that those antibodies in the convalescent plasma, because this is really what convalescent plasma is about, infusing a patient with antibodies that can fight the virus. They seem to work in that middle group of patients who have moderate to early in the severity of disease where they're requiring some oxygen support.
So timing, very important. And these this plasma is coming from people who have recovered from COVID-19, donating their plasma. Do you have enough of it at your hospital?
We've had enough to offer to the patients that we have that have qualified for it so far. It sort of is kind of as we go along type of supply, because we're really dependent on people making those plasma donations. And there's also, it also depends on what the blood type is, because we do have to match. So sometimes we're in a situation where we have plasma, but it's not the right blood type. But generally speaking, we haven't run into big shortages or discrepancies.
Are you optimistic about convalescent plasma and the treatment here? Do you see this type of treatment staying with you in your hospital?
We're fairly optimistic. We do have a trial where we're trying to learn more about who exactly and when exactly we should give this. So teasing out those details. One of the other things that we'd like to learn that we're not able to do right now is be able to measure the level or concentration of antibodies in plasma and determine exactly how much do we need to help a person recover. And if we know that, then we're able to measure the antibodies in a plasma donation and see would that be enough for just one person, two people. Do we need to give them two or more, and just be a little more specific or refined in our administration?
Dr. Jerry Wainaina is an infectious disease specialist leading Froedtert Health's COVID treatment protocol. If you care for COVID patients in your healthcare setting, have you seen treatments evolve or stay the same in these few months? Are you using convalescent plasma? What looks promising to you? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Wainaina, we heard from Joanne in Mount Horeb, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Joanne wants to know what you think of antithrombotic drugs and anticoagulant drugs in the treatment of COVID-19.
That's a very good question. One of the things we've seen with COVID-19 is the development of blood clots in blood vessels, in the legs and in the lungs. And we've been trying to determine who is at risk, who exactly has developed this, you know, without moving patients around the hospital too much. One principle we've been able to establish is because they're at risk, then we should probably protect them. And there's a way we can do that using certain anticoagulants at low dose to protect them. So this would be called prophylaxis. It's a little trickier to make the diagnosis with the limitations of moving patients around. But when we do make a diagnosis of a blood clot in the patients, you know, blood vessels in their legs or in their lungs, and those are patients that we would give anticoagulants or blood thinners. And so we have a protocol written out by our hematology or blood specialists for that.
Let's look at remdesivir for a moment, another treatment that's come in response to the pandemic, an antiviral drug. What do you see are the benefits and drawbacks of remdesivir?
So remdesivir is a new medication that has been trialed in other situations, most recently for Ebola. And it seems to have some activity against SARS and MERS, and now looks promising for COVID-19. The big study that was announced by Dr. Fauci showed that patients who got remdesivir improved faster, and there was maybe a little signal that suggested that they were less likely to die. So we think that this is useful. However, as we dug into the details, we recognized, again, there's an issue of timing. It seems to work best when given early, so within 10 days of symptoms. And it also seems to work in those patients who have moderate to severe disease. By the time a patient is on a ventilator or on extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, which is another type of invasive oxygenation, they may not benefit as much as a patient who hasn't quite gotten there. And then the patient with mild disease doesn't really seem to benefit from this at all.
Do you find that you're putting fewer patients on ventilators?
We definitely are. When we moved to nursing our patients in prone position early. So as soon as they're admitted, when they're in the hospital room, not before they go to the ICU, we noticed that we were able to avoid having patients transferred to the ICU. Our ICU transfers declined. The patients who needed to be on ventilators also declined.
How are you doing with PPE? Do you have enough of the protective equipment?
Right now, I am thankful to say that we have adequate PPE. We have different levels for different needs. And, you know, there's always and there's very careful tracking of who is using what and, you know, making sure that what people need is available to them.
Are you having to reuse PPE or clean it and use those masks again?
That is some of the protocol. We do have some reusable masks that they're not disposable. So those ones people would have to use, have cleaned, and then reuse. We are wearing our masks longer than we normally would outside of a pandemic. And that's because we're wearing masks within our facilities all day.
All day long, yeah.
Yes. So, you know, typically, with the outside of a pandemic, you'd put on a mask when you're going in to see a patient or when in contact with a patient who has a airborne or droplet, a disease that's transmitted by airborne particles or droplets. And then when you're done with them, take out your mask and dispose it. But given the known and well-established community spread, the fact of asymptomatic patients, which could be me, or my patient, we are wearing masks all day to protect our patients from us and to protect us from what our patients may have.
Dr. Wainaina, you described just a deluge of information at the beginning that was spreading out to doctors around the country and around the world as doctors shared information. What therapies do you think are the most promising now? What are physicians really dialing into?
Right now, the most promising treatments or therapies, at least in my view, looking at the landscape right now, would be convalescent plasma. Remdesivir is very promising. There is some work looking into hyperimmune globulin as well, which really all that is concentrating the antibodies that would be in plasma. Or finding a way to synthetically manufacture them and use them. So it would be the same principle. There are other treatments, those dexamethasone, as we mentioned earlier, that the dexamethasone trial that was announced from the UK. I thought those results were very promising. As with everything, we really do need to understand the details. This was a very complex trial, and teasing through the details to understand exactly who this worked in, at what point we should be using this would be good to understand. Steroids have been used for many patients throughout this pandemic in different ways. So I think this just confirms that.
Dr. Wainaina, thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Jerry Wainaina leads Fraidert Health's COVID treatment protocol. Coming up, we take a look at what might be behind the recent increase in La Crosse County's COVID cases. We talk with an infectious control specialist from Gunderson Health right after this news update here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're heading now to La Crosse County, where a recent uptick in cases has the county publishing a list of high-risk businesses after some customers and staff have tested positive for COVID-19. The list includes a dozen businesses, including bars. Do you live in La Crosse County? Are people socially distancing themselves? Are you a business owner in the area? Have you reopened? What safety measures do you have in place? We're at 800-642-1234. Megan Meller is an infection control specialist at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. Megan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me this morning.
Well, let's start with the numbers. The La Crosse Health Department reported 23 new cases, bringing the total to 290 yesterday. What are you seeing in the trend lines?
You know, from my perspective, we're doing a lot of reporting of these cases, you know, every day of the week, and we're seeing a huge increase in the number of cases. And what's most striking to me about this is we're seeing it among the 20 to 29-year-old population, which is pretty consistent with what's happening across the state and across the country.
So what is going on in that age range? Where do you see the spread?
We're seeing the spread primarily from people who have had exposures, like how you mentioned earlier, by going to bars, by going to beaches, by simply being out. In the beginning, they were kind of cropping up from, you know, businesses, having exposures from coworkers. And that's starting to change now more, and it's coming back to people being out and about and socializing again.
You mentioned that the latest cases are not a second wave, but rather La Crosse County is yet to peak. What are you seeing in terms of a peak? When might it come?
You know, I wish I could, you know, kind of foresee that. I think, you know, kind of, like I said, we really haven't seen, you know, this is really our first peak, and I honestly don't foresee it kind of going away until the end of summer, if that. I think we're going to kind of hit a plateau where we're going to see steady cases, and hopefully, you know, people start listening to more, you know, paying more attention to masking and social distancing, so that way we start to see a decrease. But I don't foresee that happening anytime soon.
The county released a list of businesses. I had mentioned some of the high-risk ones, but there was also medium and low-risk and the dates in which people should be aware of. Can you tell us about what has been published?
So what we know, so that those high-risk exposures are those where people are spending, you know, really close, a lot of time, you know, would say more than 15 minutes. So that's kind of what we're defining as that exposure period, is more than 15 minutes. Prolonged exposure, you know, less than 6 feet away, no masks. And that's pretty common when you're out at the bars, out at restaurants, out at the beach. The low-risk exposures are going to be more of those transients. So let's say TJ Maxx, for example, is listed as one of those exposures. We know that exposure in stores are going to be much more transient. So, you know, the interactions, especially with other people, are going to be much more shorter. And so, what, you know, I would encourage people, you know, no matter what, is to really be aware of where you're at. If you're going to if you want to go out to eat at a restaurant, choose outdoor seating, because we know that fresh air is going to reduce that risk of an exposure much more than sitting indoors when you don't know what that ventilation is like.
And if you have visited an establishment that is listed in La Crosse's high risk category during the specific time period that is published, you are asked to be take an assessment. Is that right?
That's right. So the La Crosse County has a form for people to fill out if they think they've met that exposure criteria. So they were in these defined areas at that time. And then what the county does is they kind of aggregate that data, they look at that, and then they refer those individuals for testing either at here or at Mayo. So we are getting those reports on a daily basis, and then we pass that on to our nurses who are running our testing center, and then they can reach out to those individuals and get them in for a test. So that way they get a result very quickly. The turnaround right now is incredibly fast.
We're talking with Megan Meller, who works at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. She's an infection control specialist, and we're looking at COVID in La Crosse County. With your questions, 800-642-1234. Do you think the state opened too early? What are your thoughts? Have you visited any of the establishments that may have exposed people to COVID-19? What do you do if you work at these establishments? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Ben in La Crosse. Hi, Ben.
Hi. My name is Ben, and I live in La Crosse, so I've been watching it unfold. As a family, we've been pretty much staying in lockdown because we knew that this spike was coming. But I guess what's disheartened me a lot, I work with college students. I'm the Lutheran campus pastor here in La Crosse, and I also adjunct. And I've just been seeing this community really vilify the student population, which I think is unfair for a few reasons. One, any failures that have happened in locking us down are happening at a governmental level. What do you think is going to happen when you tell a bunch of 21-year-olds they can do whatever they want? These are people literally without fully developed prefrontal cortexes. They can't make the higher level decisions that full adults do. They're at an age of their lives where their social lives are everything. And then the government rolls back every rule. The college students flood the bars and the beaches.
And Ben, I think we lost you there. Megan, can you respond to Ben in terms of, you know, zeroing in on the student population and what they may be feeling right now?
You know, I think they're feeling a sense of nostalgia. You know, I can speak for this myself. You know, I'm 29, and I miss those interactions of going out. And I think what, you know, some of this is brought on is, you know, people, again, you know, they know COVID is still out. You know, they know there's the risk, but it's also summer. You know, they want to go out and about, and I can't blame them for that. And this is where I think we really need to kind of reinforce the education and give them alternatives, give them really safe alternatives. You know, we did think the beach was okay, but then you have overcrowding, which, you know, brings people closer together. You're going to start having outbreaks. And so in some ways, I do think we opened too early. I think we're looking at the cases like, oh, La Crosse is, not a hot spot. It's okay to open. We're looking at the data. And then with the reopening, it really challenged this. And so, again, I would really encourage, the 20 to 29-year-old population that it is okay to socialize, but consider limiting your social group. You know, there's this term quarantine. Limit your socialization group to a small group of people so you're limiting the exposure. Hang out outside. Try to keep that distance. There's ways that we can still socialize with our friends, with our peers, without perpetuating, increasing the amount of COVID in our communities.
As cases evolve and come up, contact tracing is the next step. How have these investigations been going, and do you see the tracing being more effective?
So without, a direct insight into what's happening within the county, we know that one of the barriers for contact tracing is honesty. I think from what I've been reading, this is a trend across the country, is that the majority of people don't tend to be as forthcoming to who their contacts were. And this is a really huge barrier. You know, this is the time for people to be honest and admit to who they contacted. Because if we can identify who they were in contact with during what we say their infectious period, we can act a lot quicker. We can reach out to those people, get them into quarantine so they're not exposing others during that symptomatic period. And we have come a long way in our ability to do that. I know the county has really beefed up their contact tracing system. And, you know, we're doing all of this education in the hopes that, you know, we can reach people. We can let them know, you know, it's okay to tell us who you are with. You're not going to be punished for this. You're not going to be penalized. You're not going to be judged. This is a crucial part of public health and really kind of, you know, bringing that curve down, you know, getting us to a point where all of us can go out and enjoy going to restaurants again without the worry of COVID-19.
Your county has avoided COVID-related deaths to date. How do you see healthcare right now in La Crosse County?
You know, Gunderson has been preparing for this from the beginning. You know, I can remember back in January watching these cases creep up in China and knowing of this potential. And so La Crosse is very fortunate right now. I would say incredibly fortunate that we haven't had any COVID-19 related deaths. I think it's just a matter of time, but I know that our healthcare systems are very well prepared. We have a dedicated COVID-19 unit that we can open up at a moment's notice to take in patients. We have it, you know, we have staff who have been trained for months to feel comfortable and confident, you know, in the capacity to care for these patients. We have a really great dedicated team. So we're ready. You know, we're definitely ready for COVID, you know, for it. I still hope that we never have to use it at its full capacity, but we are prepared.
And right now, 4 people, I understand, are hospitalized. Is that about right for the count?
It is about right. So with La Crosse being a central hub for the western side of the state, we take in a lot of patients from the tri-state area. And so I think we're incredibly fortunate to serve our community in this way. So, you know, we've never been at full capacity, but we've always, you know, we're seeing these cases, you know, these COVID-19 cases starting to come in. And again, they're, you know, kind of from surrounding areas, even from our own community. But fortunately, we've been able to, you know, get them stable enough to be discharged.
And certainly COVID-19 knows no boundaries, knows no state lines. And so when you work in an area that is multiple states, that too can present some challenges, I would imagine.
Absolutely. You know, in the very beginning, we had staff kind of wondering where COVID-19 was because they weren't seeing the number of deaths in our community. They weren't seeing the number of cases. But from the infection control side, we get this really unique perspective because we're seeing all the cases that are being tested through Gunderson Health System. And we were seeing it, you know, cases from Minnesota, cases from outbreaks that were happening in Iowa. And so, like, we knew it was in the community because these individuals frequently travel up to La Crosse to, you know, to shop, to, you know, to get groceries for jobs. And so I always wanted to remind people that just because we don't have cases in La Crosse County does not mean it's in the communities we serve.
We have Megan Meller from Gunderson Health in La Crosse, where she is an infection preventionist. Are you a healthcare worker? What are you seeing in your area as far as infections? Are you concerned about a second wave of cases in the state and in your county specifically? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick this up in a minute with Megan Meller right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're zooming in on La Crosse County, which has seen a recent surge in COVID-19 infections. Have you visited any of the establishments that may have exposed people to COVID-19? Are you concerned about the possibility of exposure when you go out to bars or restaurants, other businesses, to do your shopping? Do you work at these places? What should people know? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Megan Meller works in La Crosse as an infection control specialist at Gunderson Health System, and she stays with us. Let's take another call now. Mary Kay is joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi, I've been in Kenosha and I've been in Milwaukee, and I'm concerned about a few things. I have 7 points to point out for a safer opening up of Wisconsin. First of all, you wash your hands before you put your mask on. Make the masks mandatory because there's a lot of travelers in our state, okay, at all businesses and the customers. So, again, all the transportation that's including the airports, the trains and the buses, they have to wear a mask, okay? More forced ventilation in some buildings. Hire more cleaners. Send people home that are ill, that are at work. They're chronic coughing, okay? Food vendors must wear masks and gloves because they're handling our food. Unless they're already sanitizing them. We should know if they are or not.
Mary Kay, thank you so much. Megan, I want you to jump in here with the things that Mary Kay brings to the table.
Yeah, Mary Kay brings up a lot of really great points, and that's all things that we encourage, you know, not only at work but out in the community. Hand hygiene, we know that hand hygiene works. A lot of, you know, during cold and flu season, I think a lot of one of the primary ways people get sick is they touch their T-zone, so their eyes, their nose, their mouth with dirty hands. And washing your hands before touching your face is a really good way to prevent yourself from getting sick. And that same principle applies directly to COVID-19. You know, we know it doesn't live on surfaces for an incredibly long period of time, but if someone coughs, they don't cover their cough, and it lands on the surfaces, let's say a grocery cart, and then you touch it later and then touch your face, you're directly basically inoculating yourself. So any hand hygiene, cleaning regularly high-touch surfaces is a really good way to take that risk kind of off the table. Covering your cough, staying home when you're sick. So we have a phrase at Gunderson, when is sick, too sick. In this case, if you have a mild cough that's too sick, you need to be home. And so this is a good time for businesses and companies to reevaluate their sick leave policies. So it encourages people to stay home, using financial incentives even to say, you have some sick leave, please take it so you feel better. And it's also requiring people to be honest about their own symptoms. Now, we know it's allergy season, but can you differentiate an allergy from something that's coming up that seems like a cold? Be honest with yourself, be honest with your employer, because the sooner that you recognize that, the less people you expose. Masking, we know it works. We don't, with cloth coverings, we know they're not perfect. They're not designed to be perfect. They're kind of designed to be kind of the best that we can do given the shortages of surgical masks. Studies are starting to show that these face coverings prevent.
Oh, and I think we.
The droplets.
Okay, sorry. We had just dropped you there a little bit, Megan. But now you're back.
Okay.
We got you on the face coverings. You know, last week, the La Crosse Parks and Recreation decided to close its two public beaches. What do you see there in terms of these drawbacks in trying to stop people from congregating?
If you take the beaches away, you're also going to, you know, people are going to congregate elsewhere. You know, it's hard because we know that outdoors are safe. So it's finding those ways that people can still be outdoors, can get their exercise, get their fresh air, you know, socialize without getting sick. It might be that with beaches, we have to start looking at how do you limit the number of people on the beach? How do you control that so that way you don't have packed beaches? And I hope that some of these conversations are in the works with the county of, you know, what we see in stores and restaurants, limiting the occupancy is how can you control the occupancy at some of these outdoor places?
Well, let's take another call now. Joe is joining us from Reedsburg this morning. Hi, Joe.
How do you? I got a question. I keep hearing all the time about people saying, you know, were you exposed, you know, at a certain location? I understand HIPAA laws and everything where you can't say names and everything, but it seems like it's top secret. Like in Sauk County, they got, you know, we have this hundred many cases, but you have the closest you know is Sauk County. You can drive for an hour and still be in Sauk County. You have no idea. It's super secret of where these people that got sick were before they got sick when they could have been spreading it. It's like, how do you know if you were at an establishment when they don't tell what the establishments were?
Joe, thank you for that. Megan, what about transparency here as contact tracing evolves and people say where they've been?
You know, transparency is very important. And for, you know, something like COVID-19, especially within Wisconsin, it's really going to be up to the county to disclose where that exposure is happening. Now, there's defined exposures and then what we call community spread, where you can't really pinpoint. So community spread is where you can't pinpoint exactly where that individual picked it up. But the county is looking at, okay, where was that person at when they were exposed? you know, when they got sick, you know, did they have a sick contact? Where might that have happened? And that's how the county is able to narrow down on these locations. You know, they might have one or two people who got sick at that place, let's say, at a certain store, and then realize that when you start having multiple people, you know, say that that's where they were at, you can safely say, okay, we know that this was a place of exposure, and then they can publicize that. And so transparency is very important right now with the community, with each other, because that is one of the main ways that we're going to really put a halt to COVID-19 is being open with each other, being open with everyone and indicating. But again, you don't want to jump on something too quick without, you know, having the data to support the fact that that place became a hotspot for spread.
How have you seen testing evolve in your county?
We've seen it evolve dramatically. So here at Gunderson, we were working really fast behind the scenes to bring testing on site, and we were able to accomplish that within, you know, within a matter of 2 to 3 weeks. And so we were starting to meet that demand. And then we then brought on another testing platform as well. So we've seen within La Crosse County, within our community, the ability to test, you know, hundreds of people. For example, the other day we tested 500 people for COVID-19. This is not just people who are having symptoms, though. We're also doing a lot of pre-procedural testing, so that way patients, Gunderson patients, can come in for necessary procedures to be done. But that's also important because we know COVID-19 spreads can be asymptomatic in people, can present asymptomatically. And so we're able to capture those populations too, which we would not have been able to do in the very beginning of the pandemic. And so I'm very proud of how our community has risen to the occasion to enable us to test as many people as humanly possible within a short period of time.
And I understand Gunderson is really trying to promote telehealth and to get primary care appointments done via telehealth. How is that going?
It's going really well. And what we're seeing is providers who might have been reluctant to make that transfer are now really excited about it. And, you know, I think, like, this is the future for telehealth. And I was really excited when the government kind of opened up the criteria for patients with Medicare and Medicaid to use telehealth as well. So there's no going back, and it's COVID-19 has really ushered in this new wave of medical that we can, for medical health, that we can bring in patients and we can have these interactions. Patients can still get this care without having to come into the community or without having to come into the hospital and potentially expose themselves. We've also opened up drive-up labs as well. So patients don't have to come inside a building to get a lab drawn. They can drive up in their car, be met by a nurse, and get blood drawn, get whatever lab they need to be done from their car. We've also started up drive-up vaccinations as well, so that way we're getting young children in for their annual vaccine, so we're not missing that gap as well.
Megan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Megan Meller, an infection control specialist at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. Just ahead, we discuss whether school resource officer programs will continue after protests against police brutality have erupted nationwide. We have the president of the Milwaukee Board of School Directors and a crime prevention specialist joining us to explain. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.